Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, it's me, Fran Lewis, book discussion, and I am so excited. It's about 40 degrees in New York City. It's really gorgeous, and the sun is shining, and I hope everybody's listening because I am totally pumped and excited that the author of, and I'm going to say this right, De Clans Cross is here, and it's Carla Negers, and she's New York Times bestselling author, and the Sharp and Donovan series. And when they sent this book to me, it's one of those I read in Fran time, which is like an hour and a half zap time, which means you know you're going to want to read this. So I would like to welcome Carla Negers. Hi, Carla. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be here.
I am so glad that you are here. I just want to make one or two announcements real fast, and then we're going to get into this book because people are going to want to read it, seriously. And if you haven't read it, I don't know why you're not on Amazon getting a few dozen copies for the holidays that are coming up. I don't know, people. My next show is going to be November 14th. I'm taking some time off. And my review sites, Reviewing Your Book on Facebook and Need a Review, will be taken over by Marcia Cook for a while. And that's all I'll say about that. The five books for this month, if you're a seafaring person and you like to sail, Reckoning at Sea is a true story of what happens when Max Young came face-to-face with a gray whale, and he sort of won, and he fought for his life. It was really an interesting story that I read yesterday. That was my book for yesterday, the whole one. I also read The Messiah Matrix by Kenneth John Alacrity, which is really, really good. The Recluse Story, Storyteller by Mark Sass are the books, my best picks for the month. And Public Enemy Number One by Anthony N. Walker is Abraham Lincoln, Public Enemy Number One. Okay, and now that that is out of the way, Carla, could you give us a little background on this series? Because for those people that haven't read the other ones, introduce them to the characters.
Sure. Well, Declan's Cross is the third book in my Sharp and Donovan series. Mm-hmm. It starts with Saint's Gate and then Heron's Cove. Mm-hmm. And we have FBI agents Emma Sharp and Colin mm-hmm. Donovan. They meet in Saint's Gate, and they actually grew up just a short distance from each other, but like totally different worlds in southern Maine. Emma is from a famous family of art detectives. Her grandfather is this renowned art detective who started in this town of Heron's Cove. It'll remind people who know Maine maybe of Kennebunkport, that area. Mm-hmm. But now he's based in Dublin. He's of Irish descent. And then, Emma, is an art crimes expert with the FBI, but she has a kind of a complicated and interesting past, not only just because her family are these art detectives, but also because she went into the convent for a short time. So she's a former nun. She never took her final vows. She was a kind of a novice, and the convent is on the coast of Maine. And when Saint's Gate starts, she is a former nun there. I mean, she's the former nun, sorry. Sister Joan calls her up to the convent and to talk with her, and Sister Joan ends up being killed before Emma can get to her. And that draws Colin, who grew up in the fishing village, the struggling fishing village just above Heron's Cove, and he's a former lobsterman and the Maine State Marine Patrol officer. And he has these three rugged brothers, so they're kind of really rugged guys. And he's a deep cover agent with the FBI. So these two come together in Saint's Gate, and it's very intense. And then, so they have this romantic relationship going on. And then we get to Heron's Cove, and that's another story that it's like his world. Colin has been investigating this international arms traffickers. And Emma then has this past, as the art detective, and there's this Russian tycoon who she knows, and you throw in a missing Art Nouveau collection, and we have Heron's Cove. So there's a lot going on in that book, and it's a lot of fun. And then now we have Declan's Cross, and Emma and Colin are taking a break on the southwest coast of Ireland, and of course things happen. And so that, so now we have Declan's Cross.
Yeah, well, they definitely, things happen right away. So who is Lindsay, and why is she going there?
Oh, we have Lindsay Hargreaves. Actually, she Declan's Cross opens with her. And Declan's Cross is the name of, has multiple meanings, but it's the name of this little village on the South Irish coast. For anybody who's been to Ireland, it's in the Ardmore area, and that's the area where St. Declan lived and had a little monastery, and he's one of the very early Irish saints. So it's ancient ruins. He's lived around the same time as St. Patrick, mm-hmm. So it's on the coast of Ireland, and Ireland is also a dolphin and whale and porpoise sanctuary. And Lindsay is fascinated by both. So she is a marine biology mm-hmm. enthusiast. She loves whales and dolphins. And she has a difficult past, and so she's going to start this. She has some money that she's going to put and create this field station, and it's all complicated. But anyway, she's on the South Irish coast there, in Little Declan's Cross, opening up the story, and she's right on the cliffs. You can imagine the sea cliffs in Ireland, and she hears something, and then we don't know quite what happens to her. So she basically disappears, and enter Emma and Colin and a friend of theirs from Maine who knows Lindsay and shows up in Declan's Cross.
Well, the prologue I won't talk about because that really starts it off. That was
mm-hmm.
an interesting prologue, and I'm very proud to say I figured that one out, but it took a while. That was really interesting. Yeah, I'm terrible. I usually try to figure it out. Okay, so Julianne comes there, and
right.
she gets there, and she can't find her, so what does she do?
All right, so Julianne is a marine biologist, young marine biologist. She's getting her master's in marine biology and waiting tables in Colin's hometown, this little fishing village. And she's had a difficult relationship with Colin's brother, Andy, who's a lobsterman and who just, he barely survives Heron's Cove, the story, the previous book. So they're on the skids, and she's just taking the bull by the horns, and this woman comes, Lindsay, and says, come to Ireland with me, and, we'll start this field station. You can help out, because Lindsay's going to be an intern in Cork in Ireland. And so she shows up in Declan's Cross, and Lindsay's supposed to meet her very early in the morning. These flights from Boston arrive like the crack of dawn, and so she thinks, well, okay, she's supposed to meet me, but she didn't, so maybe she just overslept, and then things then go, okay, I don't know what's going on. So she drives herself to Declan's Cross for the first time on the left, so she's like frazzled when she gets there, and there's still no Lindsay. And it's like, I don't know if you've ever had somebody who just hasn't shown up, done something they're supposed to, but you don't really know them that well, and maybe something's bad, maybe something happened. I don't know what's going on. So she's not sure what's happening, but she doesn't realize that, Emma and Colin, her, the FBI agents, she knows they're in Ireland, another, southwest coast, having this break. They're supposed to be about to head home. Well, they hear that she's coming to Declan's Cross, and alarm bells go off for Emma, because Declan's Cross is also the site of an unsolved art theft that happened 10 years ago. And Emma's grandfather investigated. And not only has it not been solved, but they believe that the same thief has hit in various cities around the world through these 10 years. So this is somebody they really want to find. So they're like, okay, all the little Irish villages that Julianne could choose, why Declan's Cross? So they're already on alert. And then they get there, and it's like, well, okay, now Lindsay, who seems to have no connection whatsoever to art, I mean, she likes whales and dolphins. So she's disappeared. What's going on? And so that's how that all kind of comes together in the first few chapters of Declan's Cross.
It does, and I didn't, this time I was able to follow because it did not need This is amazing. These people don't even listen. Yeah, I mean, I was able to follow this from the start without needing a character map. Sometimes I'd sit down and I'd say, okay, this I need this, and this, like with the book I'm reading now that I won't say that we were talking about before, there are so many characters in it and so many different people, and I'm going like, wait a minute, didn't he just talk about this one? Did he just talk about that one? Why is he talking about this one that has nothing to do with that one? So I was able to follow. But
trying to follow characters and introduce characters, especially when you're developing a series where as a writer, I'm sitting there writing, and I know that there's going to be people who read Declan's Cross first and haven't read Heron's Cove or Saint's Gate. So they're being introduced just to Emma and Colin for the first time and their backgrounds, and they have these two strong families and they're two strong characters, and their relationship is ongoing. So how do you make that so that the reader can come into it and not be confused? And it really is fun to do.
Yeah, well, what's good is that you had some backstory, but not a lot. And it didn't take up a lot of time to figure out who everybody was. But how much research did you have to do when you wrote this? Because it looked like you did a lot of research. And by the time you started to describe some of these places, I wanted to put off what I'm doing next week that I don't want to do and go there instead and have more fun.
I wish you could. Yeah,
me too.
There was a lot of research involved in Declan's Cross because it's set in Ireland, so that's a fun place to research, obviously. But I've been to Ireland many times. Like, we go a couple times a year, and in fact, this year, three times. So we do love it. Excuse me. But the research itself is, for one thing, the marine biology part of it. It's not a heavy part of the book, but you do have to know some things about what's going on in Julianne's mind, and that just happens to be a very big interest of mine. So I keep tabs on it, and I love it. And then Ireland was deciding, well, what part of Ireland? And I could just see when we were in Ardmore and we were walking along the sea cliffs, and they're just amazing there. And then you come into these, there's a 12th century round tower that rises above the village, and these ancient ruins and these Celtic crosses. And it was just the atmosphere of the area just really gripped me. And I thought, you have this mix of the really modern Ireland and at the same time these ancient ruins and the sea, just the drama of the sea. And so it made sense that the story would be there, but that, of course, involved more research into St. Declan. And then we have just the Irish stuff, creating a hotel and just some of the language. There's a sheep farmer and that Irish detective, Sean Murphy, who's a major character
my next question, because he's so cute.
Yeah, he's a good, I enjoyed having him. And he was injured. And, in fact, he plays a small role in, I've done an e-novella called Rock Point that is a kind of a prequel to the series. And it has Sean Murphy plays a role in that story. And he was injured in chasing smugglers. And so he's been recuperating, and he's and working on his family sheep farm and debating what's next for him. Mm. And here comes Julianne. He's renting a cottage to her, and here comes these two FBI agents, and he already knows there's the art theft. So the research was just basic things like about sheep farming, and I have a great, great Irish friend who was so helpful with all of that, and not to mention whiskey research and hotel research. So all of that stuff is, to me, it's fascinating, and I could get lost in research, but I always keep the story front and center in my mind. But the Ireland part, and of course, then there's the art. There's a artist, Jack Yates. It's two paintings by him that are stolen, and he's the younger brother of William Butler Yeats. So that was fun to research too. So, and just dive in. I mean, it's a mix of stuff you know a little bit about, you find out more, I talk to people, I go places. It's really a fun series to research.
Not only that, I was waiting for the pictures because I wanted to see the paintings and the beautiful scenery in Ireland, since I'll never get there at the rate I'm going. So it's just like I was waiting at the end of the book saying, okay, did she take pictures? I want to see this in real life.
I do. I have pictures. I put up a lot on my Facebook page, and I have pictures on my website, and I also have these videos that I've done that include the Irish scenery. So if you go to YouTube and you type in my name and Declan's Cross, they'll come up. And then on my website, there are links to the pictures. And I blog. I throw up pictures every now and then of Ireland, because it's so scenic, and you can really when you see that it's even just the stone. One of the things I love about the cover of Declan's Cross,
covers right in front of me.
Oh, the way they captured the art department and my publisher, the way they captured just the stone, the atmosphere, the colors, but also just the stone arch. And, you know, when I got a mock-up of the cover to begin with, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I hope they can pull this off, because, you know, it's just a mock-up. And they said, trust us, we got it. And then I sent them pictures of the stone. You know, there's just something about that. With the ruins, if you go like on this this cliff walk in Ardmore, and there's a ruin of a church and a holy well, and just the white lichens on this old stone, and I just that they could capture that and still keep the cover kind of suspenseful and moody and atmospheric. I just really love what they were able to do with it.
The cover says it all, but they'd have to understand it to read the book. They'd have to read the book to see where that's coming from. That was one of my questions at the end, but I'll ask it now. What the heck? When you get the cover of the book, do you have the right to say you don't like it, or do they just pick it? Because that's a question I've asked other people. And what happens when the inside flap? I mean, from the inside flap, I got the gist, which was good, of what the book was about. But they didn't give away too much. And yet sometimes they give away too much on the inside flap. So who decides what goes on the cover, you know, finally? And who decides what goes on the inside flap?
In my case, it's really a consultative process.
Uh-huh.
So we talk with my agent, my editor, and I, and then the editorial director, and we go back and forth. The process starts obviously with the book, but they ask for what they call an art fact sheet, and it's a really handy tool because it helps us all focus on, okay, what are some elements? What's the tone? What do you think about when you think about this title, Declan's Cross, and what atmosphere do you want on the cover? What are some of the elements? And they also ask, what don't you want? And that's a fun one. Like one of the things I said is I don't want like real strong like blood and guts, that kind of thing, because that's not the kind of suspense that I write, so it wouldn't be accurate. So I mean, I don't really need to say that because they know that. And then they come up with concepts, and we look at the concepts, and usually there's something there that we like, and if there isn't, they're very, very good about going back to the drawing board, because a lot of times they'll know. It's like, I'm going to show you these, but I'm not sure we're in the right direction, so we want to think about this some more. And I'm just very fortunate to have such input, but also such really great art people, because I'm not an artist. So sometimes there'll be an element of a cover art, and I go, I don't know, for instance, on Declan's Cross, it's like, okay, is that purple okay? I don't know. So, I mean, I like it, but in terms of how an art department works at a publisher, I look to them for their expertise, just like they look to me for my expertise. So I have my opinions about stuff, but to me, it's always a process of looking at the cover and, do you like it? Would I pick that book up? Does it describe the book? And then when it comes to the cover copy, the inside, the flap copy there, I don't write it from scratch. I don't, cover copy. I mean, I swear I'd rather write a whole book than write cover copy. It's just for me, it's just not how my mind works. And so, but I can take, if we go back and forth. I mean, they have the book, they have the synopsis, they have the title, and so then they have copywriters, and they'll do a draft and send it to me, and then I'll say, okay, well, I changed my mind about this thing since I told you last, you know, in the story, so something won't be accurate. And then you raise a really interesting point, Fran, when you talk about the giving away too much of the story.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I pretty much knew what this is. It made it easier for me to read the book. I mean, I would have gotten it anyway. But I've read some books by some authors where I said, oh, my God, I don't have to read the book. I know who did it. And
even if you know who did it. But sometimes it's like, you know, like say you have a plot point, like a murder, and it doesn't happen until 150, 200 pages into the book, and then that's in the cover copy. If I'm reading along in the book thinking, okay, well, when are we going to get to the murder? So so it's really tricky because you want to hit the high notes because you want to intrigue the reader. You can't just have cover copy that says, okay, the book's set in South Coast of Ireland, and we've got a missing woman, and okay, buy it.
Nobody's going to pick that up. Yeah.
Right,
no one's
going
to pick that up.
I
know.
Right. Yeah, so it's like you're going to have a little more than that. But it can be tricky to figure out exactly what to say. And I think we ended up with really good cover copy for Declan's Cross, and I appreciate you noting that.
Yeah, I did. I mean, there was one author, I won't say who, and I had the cover copy in front of me, and I said, oh, my goodness, I know the connection between this character and that character, that the new one that you brought in, and I did not read the cover copy. And anyone reading the book would have, I don't know if they would have gotten it as fast as I did. It took me 3 seconds to figure it out. And the person said, you are 100% right. I asked that that be redone, and they didn't get it done. Since then, they haven't. The person has been able to get all the covers changed and written the right way. Not only that, but I've gone on Amazon many times, you know, to check to see the summary of a book when I first get it, and I found sometimes even on Amazon some of the summaries are wrong and some of the characters are wrong.
Oh, yeah.
It's just me picking up things, like, out of nowhere.
Yeah. Well, you've obviously got a good eye and a good memory.
Yeah, that's what they tell me.
But a lot of readers do. I hear from readers, and you know, they do pick up on everything. And I'm a reader myself, so I pay attention to these things too. And sometimes I don't even want to read much of the cover copy. If I know I'm going to buy the book for sure, I just I read just a little bit of it, and I'm more likely to read the first couple of pages and say, okay, I'm going to buy this book. Because I love to read, you know, this, especially with an author that I'm not as familiar with, and you know, as opposed to the what we call the auto buy, you know, where people I automatically buy and want to read. But all of these elements are so important to letting readers know what kind of book it is, whether it's something they're going to want to read, so that they can make the best decisions that they can about what to buy. So it really is an interesting process. And, of course, as a writer, I love to write. I just love to dive into the story and think about all of that stuff. So, you know, what's going on with my characters? Where do they go next? And so that's what I focus on. And then so coming up for air, as I call it, and having to focus on cover copy and cover art and all the elements, you know, which quotes you use and can – I enjoy that part, but I have to make sure where it fits in my writing so that it doesn't distract.
I know. I'm looking at the back cover of this book, that there are no comments about Declan's Cross. So they're only about Heron's Cove and St. Gate.
Right, and that's because the cover was done at the same time the book was finished. So the book wasn't given to anybody in time to put anything on the cover. But Declan's Cross has gotten some wonderful reviews. Kirkus
well,
reviews
mine's there.
Really great. Oh, great.
I hope it's there. I'm pretty sure it's there. I did post it. I'm pretty sure I did give it my usual golden. No, I don't give everybody 5 golden stars. I'm very fussy. But I'm pretty sure I did, unless they're going to tell me it was to one of those blog tour things, which I don't think I... Oh, yeah, I did. I posted it on October 8th. It said right there, post Carla. I have this on my computer calendar. Otherwise, I won't remember. I won't remember who I am half the time. And after, who knows, whatever, next week. Okay. So there are two other characters that I found very interesting, and I read their story. That would be Kitty and Sean.
Mm.
So what is with these two?
Well,
I still think
Kitty,
he's the guardia. He's so cute. Oh,
my guardia detective, Sean Murphy,
yeah.
The sheep farmer detective. He's just he's quite a guy. And Kitty is he's had an on again, off again relationship with Kitty because, and she is she owns this O'Byrne House Hotel, and that.
Mm.
She inherited it from the house. It was kind of this rundown house that she inherited from her uncle, and it's a big house, like a manor house on the coast, right on the water, in the village of Declan's Cross. And she's decided to convert it into a boutique hotel, and I love boutique hotels, so that was fun. And she's got a little spa in there, so that's what she's doing. But she is also divorced and has a son who's a teenager now, and works at the hotel and is trying to figure out what's next for him and his life. He's just graduated high school and all of that. So Kitty is available, but at the same time, Sean is trying. He's been in Dublin as a detective, and now he's been injured on the job and recuperating and figuring out whether he's going to be this sheep farmer in follow the family. His uncle owns a sheep farm, and so they when we go back to 10 years ago, when what was then the rundown uncle's house was broken into and art stolen, and there was an ancient stone cross, these two Yeats paintings and another unsigned painting of these mysterious Celtic crosses on a headland in the village. Okay, so Kitty was in the village at that time, but that's a little mystery because she and Sean have had that relationship, and they're trying to figure out. So there's little sparks flying between Sean and Kitty, and it goes back to this, the art theft, this unsolved art theft, and as well as just they've known each other for a long time, and what does that mean? So, and how do they live their lives? And then she has her son in there, who's he's caught up with these divers. That's Lindsay. Back to Lindsay, our missing American whale enthusiast. She's also a diver, and she gets caught up with these Irish and an American diver, and they're part of the whole field station, creating this field station to study whales and dolphins. It's just a little thing. In the field station, that's one of the. It's not like when I thought of a field station, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like some the New England Aquarium or something. But it's just this little garage, and Lindsay has lots and lots of ideas, and so the son, Kitty's son, is diving and caught up with these guys, and then when Lindsay goes missing, it adds to the tension between her and Sean, and because the kid is, what does he know about what's going on with this missing diver, and what does it have to do with, if anything, with this art theft? So there's lots of little pieces that we put together, but we have three relationships. We have our Julianne and Andy, the lobsterman and the marine biologist, and she's kind of run away from home to just kind of give herself a chance to pull herself together, and now everything's going wrong, and what is she going to do about that? She's a really strong character, but she can be very impulsive, and she's trying to figure out her life. And then we have Sean and Kitty, the guarded detective and the hotel owner, and then we have Emma and Colin, our FBI agents.
Yeah, those two are quite a couple. They're quite different.
That creates the fun between them and a lot of intensity, and it also influences the suspense, because we have these two strong characters, and they've gone now at Saints Gate, Heron's Cove. This is the third book, and what's going to happen with them and their relationship.
I know, and I can't tell who's running the show there. Well, we won't tell them who's running the show there. We won't tell them who thinks they're running the show there, but there's really someone else. So who is Wendell Sharp? That's my next question.
Oh, Wendell.
I like
is,
Wendell.
Oh, he's for me, I just think he's really a fascinating character. He's Emma's grandfather.
Like,
and he started out, he's in his 80s, early 80s, and he started out as a museum security guard. And he got into fine art recovery, theft and recovery, and just by happenstance. And he had his office first in Heron's Cove, and then he moved. He was born in Ireland, and now he's moved back to Dublin. And he's thinking about going back to Heron's Cove. So we have a guy who's late in his later years and dedicated to his work. It's been his life to such a strong degree, and he has this, you know, he has this one son who is part of the business, but he, this is Emma's father. He was injured. He just had a freak fall and is in chronic pain, and so he's a restless soul. And he wasn't going to be there to run Sharp Fine Art Recovery, but the Emma's older brother Lucas Sharp took over. So we have Lucas and Wendell's relationship. It doesn't play that big a role in Declan's Cross, but it certainly does in Saints Gate and Heron's Cove, and what. You know, just him taking over the business and then Wendell's role. And Wendell, I think he's a guy who has a lot of information in his head and not necessarily written down or put on a computer. And that, his sort of his secrets. And that affects Emma and Colin's relationship because, as we say, Emma has her secrets. Mm. And Colin has his demons, and that creates a lot of opportunity for stories as well as some tension. So Wendell is he does play a role in Declan's Cross because he's giving up his Dublin office, and he still has his apartment there, and he's working sort of part time. But is he going to retire? What's going to happen with him? But he decides to just drive across Ireland. It's not that far, but he goes on his kind of walkabout of the Southwest Coast. So he's been wandering around and figuring things out. So, and then it's, what does he know about this art thief? Is there something about this serial art thief that he hasn't told anyone, including Emma?
Mm. And then we have another character. We have Lindsay's father, David. And he comes in out of nowhere, too. He's kind of interesting also. And everybody in this book has their own secrets, that's for sure, that we're not going to tell.
It really is. I think it sort of fits with the atmosphere of this little village.
It's like eerie,
David Hargreaves was, you know, he was an interesting character to wrap my head around, to have him kind of, I could see him walking in on the scene. And he and Lindsay have a difficult relationship. He married her mother and adopted her when she was a little girl, and then they got divorced. And the mother was just, she couldn't quite get her life together and died young. So Lindsay kind of blames him for that. And they meet in Dublin, and right before the story starts. And then she goes on to Declan's Cross, and then he follows her and is meeting her there. By the time he arrives, she's already missing. So he's trying to figure out what's going on. But we also have our FBI agents who say, well, is he just pretending to try to figure out what's going on, or does he already know? And is he involved somehow in her disappearance? So it gets kind of, you know, that's part of the fun of the book, is having all these different elements come together and try to sort them out and just let them be on the page. You know, that just like he's a character who comes on and this is what he's saying, this is what he's doing at that time. Because he's from north of Boston. He's a wealthy guy. And we have back in Boston, we have Andy Donovan, and he's one of Collins. He has the three brothers, Collins number two, and Andy's number three. But the eldest, Mike, is there, and he's a wilderness guide way down East Maine. So Mike and Andy get involved in this whole investigation and try to figure out what's going on with David Hargreaves. Is he really on the up and up? You know, has he told Emma and Colin everything? You know, is he hampering the investigation into the whereabouts of Lindsay or not?
Well, they sort of get in trouble anyway for doing that too.
So
That was hilarious. They go like they're trying to help, and they're going, "You guys shouldn't be doing that." And they get in trouble, and they said, "Well, we're going to take you in if you don't stop it."
Yeah. Andy and Mike are sort of like non-compliant, as it were. They're fun characters.
My kind of people, definitely. Do it my way or forget it. I love people like that. My sister was impulsive, and you never knew what she was going to do either. That's why I miss her, because I'm starting to be like that also. You know, sometimes you just get a thought in your head, and you don't think about what you're doing like they don't. And with right, wrong, or indifferent, you just have great intentions, and oh well, whatever happens, happens. So what?
That's right. Yeah, you might run into an upset FBI agent, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, who cares, right? And they didn't even think about, you know, what they're doing. They just, okay, we're going to help you out. No problem. We can investigate. No big deal. And so what if we get arrested? Or so what if we get caught? And so what if anything happens to the bad guys?
Yeah, because they're concerned about Julianne. Yeah. You know, Andy, it's like he thinks he's over her. He's like the best
he's not
thing.
Over her.
Yeah, he thinks, oh, okay, well, I did her a favor by dumping her, you know, and he's convinced himself because she should go on and live in this big world, and he wants to stay in Little Rock Point, their fishing village, and he's happy with his life, and he doesn't want to hold her back, but he's not. You know, he does a thing where you just assume you know what's best for somebody instead of letting them figure it out, and then Andy's got his mission. Cut out.
I have a hello for you. I got a special hello from John Land. He just emailed me.
Oh, John!
He said to say hi, and I'm going to tell him that I don't know if he has his phone, that he can call in and say hello. But, yeah, John Land says hi to you. He said, you know, he told me that you were wonderful, but I knew that before.
Oh, John is one of my favorites. I'm an early reader of his Caitlin Strong books. I love Caitlin. She's just such a great character.
Yeah, well, she's coming back in another book that I'll probably get very soon. But it is his new one, The Tenth Circle. Oh, my God, this Reverend Jeremiah Rule. What a sick man this one is. Now, he said that he picked a villain that has a strong supporting system, but not where it required a lot of money. And what this guy does, oh my God, what they want to do to the world and take over the world, and why he wants to eliminate all the Muslims in America and anybody that's Islamic or anything. It's scary.
John has an amazing imagination, so I got to put that on my.
Not only does he have an amazing imagination, but I checked out his research too, because he knows I'm going to do it. And the research is great, because I learned a whole bunch of things. You know what the good part about it is? I never have to buy any books. I just get them. Like I got yours, and I'm gonna make sure I get the next one too. They better send me the next one. So we talked about the Celtic Cross, and what is the role of the Guardia in Ireland? Because I know they're for real. So what if they were really there, and Sean was really there? What would he have really done to Mike and Andy when he found out they were putting it?
I love Mike and Andy.
Sorry.
He's a Garda detective, and the Garda are the police force in Ireland. So he's just a detective, and he's been based in Dublin and with a special investigative unit there, and so they're the cops. So when Emma and Colin are FBI agents, but they have zero jurisdiction in Ireland. That's not their territory. So a missing woman, even if it's an American, it's not their job to investigate. But Sean isn't the He's not really, I mean, he's, of course, he's a detective, and he's technically would be on duty because of that, but he's not assigned to Declan's Cross. He's just there, and he has his own relationships with the people in the town, and including Kitty, but also his uncle, who was at the house at the O'Byrne house when the art theft took place 10 years ago. Mm. So Sean has a lot going on, but it's really it's the role of the police to investigate their crimes in their jurisdiction. Mm. So Emma and Colin are in a way walking on eggshells, because there's only so much that they can do, but they cooperate. And that creates another layer of tension, actually, in Declan's Cross.
I don't know who this is. Let me find out. That might be the second author. I have no idea. I'm going to have to wait. What can I say? Let me just check. I can always put them on hold. Alan? Hello?
Hello?
This is Fran. Who is this?
This is Jay.
Yes, and go on. I can't hear you.
Okay.
Is this
Alan? Are we on with Tyler right now?
No, not really. You can put your question in the chat room if you like. The author doesn't take questions on Alan unless I know who it is. So I don't know who that is. I have no idea. That was somebody that just called in from another area code. I have no idea. So unless I know who it is, I don't take questions in the chat room. Question, you know, out loud. If the person wants to put their question in the chat room, that's okay. Okay, so how do we know that there's somebody still out there, you know, that this thief is still out there and that this person is still out there taunting Wendell and everybody else?
Well, the thief is an interesting character the thief has managed to elude not only Wendell Sharp, but the FBI and law enforcement in various countries and the whole Interpol connection to it. So this is a very smart person. I don't think this is too big a spoiler.
Yeah.
But after every theft, the thief sends a little cross. That is kind of a crude copy of the cross stolen that night from the O'Byrne house 10 years ago. So there's a little bit of taunting that goes on there, absolutely. And the question is, see, 10 years, the thief has never turned to violence. So if we have missing Lindsay, and missing Lindsay turns up dead and turns up murdered, is it the thief or is it someone else? So that plays into the whole story, too.
Well, there are a lot of characters that I'm not going to mention because we don't want to give away anything. And will they figure out who did it? Never. You're not. I mean, it took me a while, and I figure out things right away. No, never. This was good. This is a well-kept secret, and they're not going to figure it out why. And what happens at the end? Well, you have to read it for yourself because I'm not going to tell you. So when you write your novels, so we don't give any more away, do you outline the chapters and the plot, or do you put down, or do you do like a character map and what you want the characters to do first?
It's kind of a chicken and egg question for me because everything happens so simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
So with Declan's Cross, I knew from Heron's Cove that Emma and Colin were in Ireland, and I knew where they were. They were in this little cottage owned by Finian Bracken, who's an Irish priest, a very interesting character, our Finian, who's serving a church for a year in Rock Point, in Colin's little fishing village. Finian has a tragic background, and this is the little cottage that he owns. So they're staying there. So I had that. I knew when I started out that I had that as a given. I knew these characters. I knew what was going on in their relationship. And I knew some of the Finian Bracken's background and the other, this world that I created of the Sharps and the Donovans, this whole world. And then it's like, okay, so what's going to happen? And something's going to happen in Ireland, and where is it? And so it was. So I asked myself a lot of questions at first, and that just kind of helps me to pin things down, because I'll have little snippets, the bits of dialogue, little scenes. Oh, I could do this. Oh, I could do this. Blah. I think of it as the possibilities, all the possibilities.
Mm.
There's this wonderful writer, Kenneth Achety, and he has a book called A Writer's Time, and he talks about the continent and the islands, okay? And the islands, you go out into the islands of possibility, and you just paddle around, and and you think about your story, and anything could happen. And when I'm in that phase, I'm writing a little scene here, I'm writing what-if questions, I'm brainstorming, and I'm just, like, going with it. And that's part of the outlining process, but it's also part of the character process, because everything from me comes from character. I'm not one who says I'm going to write a book about a serial killer. I don't think that way. I'm going to write a book about arms traffickers. I'm going to write a book about an art thief. I don't think that way. It comes out of the characters in the setting. So, like for Saint's Gate, I could see, and I didn't have all these characters set then in my head, but I could see Emma Sharp arriving at the convent gate on the coast of Maine. And I knew a nun was going to be killed. And then I'm like, okay, so who is Emma? And she starts to emerge. Mm. So that's how. And then the continent, what Ken actually calls the continent, that's when you come back and you say, now I've got to make some sense of this. I've got to start writing. I've got to have a beginning, middle, and end. And what do I do? And so I'll do a little bit of outlining, but I'm writing at the same time, because things come together for me as I write. But I do, I don't just do total seat of the pants either. I also have the, some of these ideas and plotting, but it's more like jumping off points, and then I'll write 7,500 pages, play around with things, and go, okay, I got some things now, and then I do a little more outlining and writing. And so I'm not one of those writers who writes an outline and then sits down and writes, 7 or 10 pages or 15 pages or whatever it is a day, and then polishes that and sends it in. I don't write like that.
A lot of people do that. Let me just check and see who this is in 1 minute, because I have another caller. By the way, Kenneth Lachety wrote The Messiah Matrix, one of the best books I've ever read.
Oh,
you've got to read
guy.
It. Oh, my God. That one is about Jesus and who he really was, and who, in relation to Augustus Caesar. You got to read it to believe it. I just sat there and I looked up the research, and the research is there. It's one of my better books for this month also. I'm not sure if that's my second author, but we're going to find out right now. Let's see. Hello, this is Fran. Is this Alan?
Hi, Fran. This is...
Hi, just 1 second. I'm glad it's you. I'm going to put you on hold for a minute, okay?
Not a problem at all.
Thank you. Okay, good. I wasn't sure if he got my message to come on second author. It's been,
awesome.
I didn't have his area code, and I wasn't sure. And the other person, I don't know who that was, and I don't take questions on my show live, because you never know what someone's going to ask. And we've had some unusual questions that we don't want asked. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So what is next for Emma and Colin? And we won't tell how the book ends, because, oh, boy, that was good. What's the next book?
Well, they're back in Boston, and we still have an Irish connection to it. But Emma is, she I don't know how much to say, because I haven't, I'm deep into the book. We're calling it, right now the title is Harbor Island.
Nice.
And and Emma is, there's an artist in Declan's Cross, Aoife O'Byrne, and there's a model that she's worked with, sort of, and she turns up dead on a harbor island in Boston, and Emma finds her. So that's kind of how we're starting out the story.
Nice, and I hope I get it. When is this coming out?
The plan is for it to be out next September.
Well, right in time for my birthday. That's good.
Oh, you're a Virgo?
Perfect person, yes. Perfectionist. with a mother that insisted that I read 10 books a week and take notes on them, which explains my book reviews, everybody. Yes, my mom believed that homework is one thing, and then you have to read at least 10 books a week, and you have to take notes on them. So that by the time I had a book report, which my own feelings about those, by the time I had a book report, it was a piece of cake. And as an educator and working with kids in reading and writing, I did everything but make them write a book report because it got boring. You know, a lot of kids write the back cover of a book or the front laugh lab, and they don't read the book. They read the beginning, middle, and end. So an oral book report or acting out a character or picking a specific spot in the book or a specific thing that you know that they had to read was my way of making sure they read the book. And,
how cool.
Yeah, I did. I did To Kill a Mockingbird with a sixth grade class, and I thought my principal was going to kill me because he said, "How could you do that?" They loved it, and we did the trial both sides.
Wow.
We changed the jury, and it was so interesting. We did Huckleberry Finn, but they wouldn't let me do Tom Sawyer for whatever reason. And they were a very bright class; they were really brilliant, and we had such a good time. It was a school in the Bronx, and they wanted to be challenged. So O. Henry short stories in the sixth grade, and Edgar Allan Poe, my favorite, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Oh, fantastic.
And the kids really loved to read, so hence my love of doing this. What can I say? So
everybody, that makes a difference.
Yeah, I loved teaching was like my greatest thing, but when my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and I had to retire, that was kind of like, what are you going to do, become a couch potato? So my sister was here back then, why don't you just read a book and review it, and why don't you try a cookbook, and I can't cook, but it started a chain reaction. If you don't know how to cook and you review a cookbook and make it funny, now people think you know what you're doing. It's great.
Oh, that's fabulous. What a great story.
Yeah, it is. Martha Cheeves' book, Stir, Laugh, and Repeat, was the first book I ever reviewed, and I compared her to Emeril and Rachel Ray, and I told them to move over because her books were great. They have little blurbs about personal things besides the recipes, and Martha does book reviews, everybody, but she puts a recipe with them. And she's going to be featured in my magazine. I have a new magazine. It's called MJ Magazine, and it's in memory of my sister, and it's for authors, readers, and writers. And I think I have your review in the third edition. I'm not sure. And I'm going to, you know, feature a whole bunch of people. So if you have any articles that you wrote on writing or writing process or anything with writing or anything that you want to add to it, feel free to send it to me, because in the next one I have Robert Degoni, Alan mm-hmm. Topol, John Land sent me a whole bunch for the last one. Iris Johansson's being featured. This one, the second one that's coming out, I hope, in the 1st of November, around there, featuring Iris Johansson.
I love Iris.
I love Iris, too. And my interview with Tess Gerrinson is coming in the second one. So I'm going to feature.
Oh.
Yeah.
All kinds of good people here. Yeah. MJ Magazine? MJ is?
MJ Marcia Joyce was my sister. Died 2 years ago, and I can't figure out why or how or whatever. But, yeah, she kept me on track, yeah. And it's MJ Magazine. It's an e-magazine. And I have to just go over the errors for this one, and Rayanne Thane's work is being featured in this one, as well as Alan Topol's work and a whole bunch of other authors. And I've got a whole bunch of regular contributors, Karen Vaughn, Delaney Oakes, John Augustine is listening, and he's got an article in there, Brenda Perlin, a whole bunch of new authors. And Mark Rubenstein, you know, gives me the stuff, the current events. So I'm looking for people to write something on health, politics, sports, anything that's current, you know, that will get a younger audience, that will get teens in. If anybody knows anybody that writes anything about fashion and the fashion industry, that would be great, too, anything like that.
Mm.
It's for people that actually read. And it's an e-magazine, and proceeds from the magazine go to the Marcia Wallach Fund and the Ruth Swerdlaw Law Fund at Martha Shore Hospital. It's a special fund that was set up to find the cause of Alzheimer's.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah.
That's great.
So,
good for
you. Where can everybody find out more about your books?
Well, my website is a great place to start. It's carlaneggers.com. So that's and I'm also on Facebook. You can go like my page, and we do a lot of fun things there, and I pop in just about every day, and I'm on Twitter, as well.
Well, I'm on Twitter, too, and I followed you, I think, today on Twitter. I'm Frenelina.
Good.
That was me, Frenelina. And
all
I
right. Well, Twitter. I'm kind of Twitter impaired. You know, I'm getting there. I'm learning Twitter, but.
Twitter's fun. You know what else is good? FriendFeed. It's the same as Twitter. FriendFeed. FriendFeed and Blurty. Those are good. But I want to thank you so very much. And I, you know, if you want to send anything to the newspaper, to my magazine, let me know. Veronica has my email address. It's riffy1@optonline.net. And I would be more than happy. I'm going to put your review in that in the third one anyway. And
all right. Awesome. I would love to do something.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for today. And I'm going to put down that your book is coming out next September so I can schedule another show.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much, and good luck next week.
Thank you. I'm going to need it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Alan?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. How you doing?
I am wonderful. How are you?
Hanging in there. What can I say? I just want to remind everybody that this is my last show until November 14th. I'm going to be taking a break for personal reasons, and that's all I'm going to say. Your book, The Inspirer, was really an interesting collection of poems. How did you come to decide what to write about? And tell everybody a little bit about this book.
Sure, gladly. And thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Inspire is a collection of 100 of my poems, and they basically span the time from about high school on to about a year ago. Mm. So I'm 38 right now, so up until 37, and it's a number of topics. But my poetry is not abstract. I write about life, and I write about how I view the different life events. And that's basically what the collection is about. It's a collection of how I view the world and what's happening in it.
I know. It's like a timeline sort of events. That's
yeah.
what really got my attention was that
yeah.
it just didn't hang all over the place. It had meaning. Every single poem seemed to have its own special meaning, correct?
Yes, it certainly does to me, and I'm hoping that comes through for the reader as well. But they span love, they span despair, they span trying to find out of who you really are in this world, and finding true true love. It's all over the place. It's kind of inspirational, romantic, as well as some very critical poetry about some things.
So how did you come up with the chapter titles, Short Thoughts, Journey? I have the book in my hand. Celebrations, Song Lyrics, Infatuation, True Love, and Reflections. How did you decide the correct order of the chapters and what to put in them?
Yeah, it was an interesting process because my editor had her thoughts, but my thoughts were, let's start mm-hmm. short to come out, because some
yeah.
of my poems are quite long, as you know.
Yeah.
To come out with the longer poetry right away, I thought maybe a little too much, and to put everything chronologically speaking would not organize it into chapters that have a relatable category. So I decided to kind of break them up into bits and pieces, and then I saw that a lot of my poems, especially chapter one is Short Thoughts. Those poems are very short. They're 4 to 8 lines, and they are very succinct and express in certain emotions. So I grouped them together, and they were short, so I just put Short Thoughts. Originally, I put Short and Sweet, but then some people who read it said, well, a few of them are not really that sweet, so you
mm-hmm.
may want to remove that word. So we went with Short Thoughts. Journey was really focusing on me writing certain things at different ages, at the age of 23, at the age of 33, and so on. So I called it a journey because it's somewhat a numerological journey through life. Celebrations
mm-hmm.
were really poems that I wrote for somebody, be it for my wife or my father
mm-hmm.
or my brother or somebody else. When I would go to a birthday party or a large event like a wedding, I would write a poem, and it's expected of me. Now every event that I go to, everybody expects me to write something. So I've kind of grouped them together. Song lyrics are songs that I've written. Infatuation, which is the largest chapter, is really
mm-hmm.
me learning about love and falling in and out of what I considered love at that moment. Then going into true love, that's when I actually discovered what true love is. This is when I met my wife. And finally, reflections. These are the spiritual, inspirational, kind of looking within and looking to the universe for answers.
Yeah, that was those poems. But I really, there was one poem I have to tell you that I, you know, my dad used to give my mom one long stem rose. He always every single week, and the rose has always been my very special flower. As a matter of fact, when my mom died last year, I put a rose on her stone. They carved one in. And if they could have made it red, it would have been even better, but they couldn't. But you could see that it's a beautiful long-stem rose, perfect, absolutely perfect rose. And she would have it on her thing, and each week he would buy her another rose. It was just one. It was just so special. So when you decided to write it, which poem would you say was your favorite one? Which one is your favorite? I have a ton of questions here.
Yeah, it's very difficult to say which one's the favorite because, again, it spans 20 years plus of my life. So at different points, they have been my favorite. But I guess if I had to choose, one, I would say I am what I am, and it's a very short poem, and it brings into focus who I am about, which is very introspective, but also very humorous and not taking myself too seriously. So I am what I am is one of my favorites.
Okay, where's the one that I have? What's the promise between It's Just Like Me? I like that.
It's Just Like Me? Is that the one you were like?
Yeah, Just Like Me. What's the premise behind that one? I like that poem.
Yeah, let me see. It's page 87. Let me remember
what I
was
writing.
Oh, okay,
that's right. I have the book in my hand. I always hold the book in my hand. I had Carla's book in my hand. Here it is. It's Just Like Me.
Yeah. in this case, it was again, an infatuation phase. I wanted to speak to a girl that I really liked, and I wanted to explain my feelings to her.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a way to start a conversation in my mind because, again, being at that point in time, I really didn't have girlfriends. I was always the boy who everybody wanted to be friends with, but nobody wanted to have as a boyfriend because of confidence and other issues.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of a conversation in my head, and I've been trying to explain to her how I feel. So I sat down and I wrote this, and I said, it's just me. I'm the same person, but I do have these feelings for you.
Did she ever read it?
I think so. Having to think of it, I'm not sure exactly who that was for. It feels so terrible for me to say that, but it's been so long ago, I don't even remember.
Which poem was the most difficult to write?
Maybe the most difficult to write were some of the later ones that I wrote, dealing with kind of my answers and my spiritual journey, and not in writing it as in the process, but more difficult is how do I express to people what it really feels on the inside so they can understand. So that's probably the one that I would say was more difficult than ask.
Would you ever take, this is one of my questions here, if you had to take all of these poems and all of these chapters and turn it into a narrative, into a regular book, would you turn it into a memoir? Or is it more expressive and more meaningful as a poem?
To me, I love the poetry. And again, I write prose as well. But there is something that's just so special to me about poetry, specifically poetry that rhymes, ability to put your thoughts, your emotions into a form that would be succinct and poetic. So to me, this is probably my favorite form. Although, from the memoir perspective, a lot of these poems are very autobiographical, so it certainly could be a memoir.
Now, I used to write poems with my sister when she was alive, but I used to write them about the doctors in her office and just funny things, just to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
It was
yeah.
After she died, I stopped writing poems. If I don't have my partner anymore, so once in a while, you know, I'll write something, but you know, very rarely. So why did you include a whole section on age? You know, you're not that old, so you can't be age conscious like the rest of us people over here that try to forget. You know, people, like, you get on the phone and they ask you your date of birth, and I specifically say, I don't know, that doesn't really matter. Ask me something I could tell. Ask me something I know. And
right.
They'll change, because it's none of their business. I don't care. So why did you include a whole big section on age? Was it evolving from one place to another, or why?
To me, it was more, again, from the reflective perspective. I'm probably overly self-analytical. So it's very interesting for me to understand what I'm feeling and why I'm feeling it at a particular moment. And I remember distinctly, knowing that, oh my goodness, I'm turning 23, and there are a number of things that are associated with that, and there's going to be a career change, and at 24 I got married. There were lots of things that were happening. At 33, for whatever reason, 33 to me, coming up to that number, really felt very significant, and I didn't know what the significance was, but I knew that there was something different that was going to be happening after it. So all of these kind of emotions, and as I wrote poems on or about my birthday, I thought that
25.
It would be an interesting thing. Sorry?
25 seemed to be very special, too.
Yeah, 25 was special. I've heard from readers of the book that I've spoken to a number of folks who basically gave my book to their sons and daughters who are about to go through that age, and they're going through some of the same emotions that I was going through, and they're giving it to them as a way to pinpoint that, hey, look at 10 years from now and what you're going to be thinking. Things change and stay on point. I just thought it would be interesting to share, again, because this book is really all about sharing me and what's on the inside, and sharing the experiences that we all go through from my perspective in a poetic form. So I thought it was very important for me to continue down that path and share what I was feeling as I was growing older.
Well, one of the poems that I really found very interesting was the one Believe on page 118.
Mm-hmm.
That really sort of says it all.
Yeah,
and it sort of like tells you how you should feel about your life and fears. It just was so short and sweet, and it just says it right. It just says it's perfect.
Yeah, and I wrote this. It was either at the end of high school or around college time, where I was sitting down and I was feeling melancholy, and then kind of voice came through and said "Believe." And I had to write it. And this is how a lot of my poetry is coming through. I would feel something, or words would come into my mind, or a very specific emotion is there, and I sit down and I write. I really feel, forgiving the woo-woo aspect of it, I really feel a lot of it is channeled from somewhere.
So are you going to continue to write in this type of vein? Are you going to write more poetry books and stuff, or are you going to continue with that? Or are you going to write? I'm curious. I would be curious to see what would happen if you put this into a memoir and how different it would be. Or if you wrote it as a narrative and added the poems into interspersed.
Yeah, I'm certainly considering doing that.
Just my thoughts and ideas.
No, thank you. I very appreciate it. I will always write poetry, and since I put this book together, I've written quite a bit after that. So there will likely be other poetry books that will come out. I also have a whole whole slew of poems in Russian, which is my native language. They were not included in this particular publication because most people would not understand. But there probably will be a release of Russian poetry as well.
What about the Russian poetry with an English translation? Like, if they sent me, believe it or not, The Solitude to review this year. And I said, okay, I understand a little bit of Spanish, but this is not going to help. So I went and I got the both translations.
Mm-hmm.
And my interpretation probably was quite different than most people, and they thought my review was really quite comprehensive. They didn't realize I actually understood what he was writing. And I had never read it, and I'm going like, okay, you sent me that and Madame Bovary to review. Madame Bovary was fantastic. But so when you write your poems, I mean, each poem is expresses something different in a different part of your life, and each poem says something. So which poem is mostly you?
Again, all of them are me, but if we're talking about kind of me and the essence of what I'm about, because I am a poet, I think that would be the one that really gets at the heart of who I truly am. That's the one on page 49. It's a song. So the lyrics from that song are there, and that probably would be the one that I would say is really, that's me.
I've got to find it. It's right in my hand. I have the poem in my hand. Oh, because I am a poet. Okay. Mm-hmm. The poem that I wanted you to share, which is my favorite, is, if you will, if you want to, is a rose. Because like I said, I read this and I got tears in my eyes. And I'm going like, this was my mom's favorite thing. That and my father would sing to her, Dick Haymes, Till the End of Time. And I can't find that song anywhere on YouTube or anywhere, so I can put it on my phone as my ringtone. That and Embraceable You were her two favorite songs. And her favorite flower, I'm telling you, was a rose. And every so often, my sister and I would bring her roses. And even though she had the Alzheimer's, she saw the rose, and it would just remind her, and she would go, Doc, they call my father Doc, or your dad, or something like that. So could you share that one with us? Because, you know, I don't think anybody's going to really appreciate the fact of how beautiful these poems are unless they hear a couple.
Thank you very much. This is it's one of my favorite poems as well. I wrote this in high school. A rose definitely was me of the way that I depicted at the moment. A rose exposed, its petals cold, the wind becomes its guide. It's scared, but knows it needs to hold if it's to live the night. But wind grows stronger, hail hits near, and thunders in the air. There's no more hope. It's soaked in fear and shriveled in despair. Mm-hmm. The end is close, so why deny? The life was not that bad. I guess it's time for me to fly and face the road ahead. But no! Scream something from within. You will not lose control. Do not give up. You must begin to listen to your soul. Quiet your brain. There's too much talk, too many voices speak, and your emotions are just fog that blocks the truth you seek. There is no way to inner peace through struggling with hate. Those feelings need to be released before it is too late, for only when the water is still in ocean of your mind, you can look in and see the real reflection of your kind. No more exposed has gone the night, and standing petals straight. Looking ahead, Rose says with pride, I am the maker of my fate.
That is so beautiful. It's just anybody that gives up on life and look what happens at the end.
Yeah.
It could just be not just the flower, of course, just people that, even a teen, That seems to be falling by the wayside, and just don't give up, don't lose control, don't listen to everybody, just be who you are.
Yeah, that's to me, it's a really special poem.
That sort of says it all. I really like that poem.
Thank you.
And let's see which other questions I have. How long did it take you to create this entire collection?
Well, yeah, it took me 20-plus years to write it, but the actual process of putting together the book didn't take long, I would say a couple months.
And how is it received so far? Because, I mean, I didn't know, you know, I get so many books, you know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have like 30 or 40 books inside. And at this point, what's happening is not the books that come first or the books that are there the longest. It's the ones that I look at the first couple of pages and I go like, okay, that's in my to-read pile, because if I don't read it now, I'm going to go crazy. That book's so good. And poetry books, you know, usually you put them, a lot of people will put them on the back burner, if you know what I mean. Or my other type of books I sometimes put on the back burner are self-help. It depends on what it is. So
yeah.
I had your book for about 2 weeks, and I said, okay, I have all these other books to read, plus I have this other stuff to do, and I'm saying, okay, what about this? I'm going to read this, and I'm glad I did because it made me feel better. And once you start reading this book, seriously, once you start reading the poems, you can't stop. And it's almost, even though it's not a narrative, even though it's poetry, once you start to build, you wonder what he's going to say next or what part of your life you're going to share next. And you keep the reader spellbound by each word in each poem. I don't know if you realize that.
I've heard that, and I really appreciate you saying that. You asked about the response, and the response has been very interesting because it's really, you know, you can lead a horse to water type of thing, where most people really don't care about poetry, unfortunately. And the people that are reading the book love it. And then they start giving it to everybody else to read, or they start crying, or they're really emotional because, you know, a part of the book stirs something within them or brings back memories or gives them life lessons. So people who read the book, I've heard, and the reviews, you know, there are 29 outstanding reviews on Amazon by, you know, top Amazon reviewers, including yourself. So the book is doing really well, but not very many people are reading it because most people, you know, don't know who I am, or they may not care about poetry in general.
Well, a lot of people don't understand what poems mean.
Mm.
I'm as an educator, I work with children with learning disabilities and reading, and poetry, they love poems, and they love to write. Poems are hard to write.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not every poem, as you know, has to rhyme. You can
write,
you know, in, you know, just write it in story form, story pyramid, or just a ballad or any kind of poem. It doesn't necessarily have to rhyme, but it has to say something. It has to speak to you.
Right.
And a lot of times poetry is subjective, too, because it means different things to different people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you can read Shakespeare and, you know, take Julius Caesar one way, and somebody else is going to take it and take, you know, what Mark Antony did or somebody else another way as reading the poems. Sometimes you get a poetry book where there are commentaries so that the people actually understand what the poems mean.
Right.
So I know once you start reading these poems, they really have a lot of meaning, and I can't see where anybody really wouldn't understand it. But maybe, did you ever go into a school to read these, high school or something, or like a literature class, to get kids started on understanding that poems are stories and that they're a different way to express yourself?
Not yet. It's something that we're starting to plan out, but not at the moment. The only school that I read this to was I was invited as a speaker for my daughter, and my daughter is 9 years old, into her class. So I read a couple of poems there that were more appropriate for children, and they seemed to like them a lot.
Well, yeah, it would have been interesting if they took one of your titles and rewrote it in their own way. In their own idea, you know, whatever. The teacher would have been really, that's what I would have done, picked the rose or picked believe or whatever and see what, you know, can you write 4 lines or what do you think this poem really means, or read it with a friend and discuss what it means. But it would be interesting to see what a discussion group or even a church group or a study group or a book club would think about this book. Have you done a lot of book signings with it?
Not yet. A lot of the places that you speak to are, again, not really interested in poetry or doing any book signings unless you are a laureate of some sort. And my book, I haven't really applied for many competitions yet. Just as a matter of fact, I went to the USA book competition. So we'll find out in November if I want anything for the two categories that I put it in, poetry anthology and poetry inspirational. We'll find out. Tours are going to happen next year.
Go on.
Just wanted to mention the interesting thing about this type of a book is because it's poetry, because you don't have to really read the whole book. You can just pick it up, read a few pages, read a few poems, put it down, and then pick it back up whenever you need. I've heard of people who are basically looking at the book as an oracle, if you will, of asking a question, and they're just opening up to a page and reading it and seeing if there's an answer there. So a poetry book should be very simple for people to read because they don't have to get in and read the whole 500, 600 pages. It's small, bite-sized, very comprehensible parts.
Especially this one, Just Do It.
Yeah, yeah.
That is an interesting poem. There are many parents that turn around to kids and just say, just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't quit. And there are a lot of kids that give up before they even try because somehow someone has said to them, you're not as good as I am or anything, or you can't really do it. And people shouldn't quit.
And no, they shouldn't.
You have to have faith in yourself. Oh, there's another poem here on roses. How nice. Hmm. What made you write this? You see, I love this. The book is in front of me. Nobody's getting this. Usually after I do a show, my brother-in-law takes all my books because he has them all, and then I never see them again, ever. Or I give them to the people in my building because they love what I'm books, but they understand that I write in them because I underline what I want, what I want to say. I didn't write in this one. I just circled the poems I like the best, like all of them. So what made you write Roses Are Red? I like that poem.
Roses Are Red, if I'm not mistaken, that was one I wrote for a wedding present to my cousin. Let me find it. Hang on one
page
second.
Page
44. Page 44, thank you. That's easier.
I told you the book's in my hand.
Thank you. Yeah, what this was created for was my second cousin was getting married, and I wanted to stand up there and really, give them wisdom, if you want to call it that way. And I love children's poetry, and I love, the children's poem of Roses Are Red, Violets Are Blue. And I thought that it would be very interesting, again, maybe this is my acting background coming into it, but I thought getting up there in front of everybody and starting out, doling out wisdom for somebody who's about to get married and start out by saying roses are red and violets are blue. Most people would think, okay, this is, you're ripping off or you're going to write some very simple poem, and then I go into what the actual poem is, and then I tie it to at the end, make your roses red and your violets be blue. Which makes a lot of sense once you actually read the poem and what I'm suggesting to them in their married life. So it was an interesting way for me to begin because I wanted to say that everything, when you bring it down to its simplest parts, is very, very easy to understand. And when you're getting married, the most important thing is love. So roses are red, violets are blue, and then going from there.
Yeah, that's a beautiful poem. But there's one more that I want you to share.
Sure.
And let me find it. There's a whole bunch of them that I really like. Because I think in order for people to want to read the book, usually, with a novel, it's one thing we talk about the plot and stuff. But in order for people to want to read the book, I think they need to hear some of the poems.
I agree.
So that they understand it. So could you read on page 118, because I really like this poem, Believe? That's one of them I want to hear. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And here we are. Believe, and shall receive, for worry is contempt of universal law. Believe, and let your mind be free and sharpened like a saw. To cut through doubt and your fear, believe, and you shall touch the truth. Be scared, and panic be your crutch, and suffering your tooth.
And tell everybody what that means. That's just so simple and straightforward.
Yeah, it's basically saying that if you believe, then everything is possible. If you do not believe, then what you're going to be at the mercy of is everybody else who is telling you what you cannot do. And once you do that, usually you're in pain, mental and physical.
tell me about that. I won't even deal with my with what they're going to do to my teeth next week. we're trying not. We're trying not to think about it. That's why I'm doing this. Okay. Yeah. And the other poem that I really think is very important for kids is "Each Day Brings Something Else to Learn." And my dad used to say to me, "If you don't learn something new every day, then you don't. Then you wasted your day." Because you should learn something. I learn something new every day. Every time I read a book, every time I open up a book, and every time somebody says to me, "Would you read this?" And you know, I read your poems, and of course, I understood your poems. I understood what you were trying to say, but I'm sure that other people have read it and gotten different interpretations, and that is the fun to read about poetry.
Mm-hmm. And again, there are so many ways of writing poetry, even, you know, rhyming poetry specifically. There are abstract ways. And a lot of the people that I talk to stay away from poetry because they see poetry as something that's very abstract. And that's completely different from what I try to do with my poetry, which most people call very approachable. So understandable. But yeah, everybody gets their own meaning because it's like a fortune cookie. You know, fortune cookies are generic, but the time that you receive the fortune cookie at can mean a very different thing to you. Go ahead.
There's a whole bunch of people online that want to say hello. Karen Vaughn says hello. John Augustine says hello. And Karen, I don't know if somebody read my book. My new book just came out, Lies, Betrayals, and Fear. And poor Karen, she winds up, we won't tell you which stone she winds up behind, but I promised her that I would, you know, put her behind my stone and make her a character. And, you know, since she is an author and reviewer, I can't tell you what I did to the poor girl. But she has a question. Would he write prose or a novel? And if so, what kind? She wants to know.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of writing 10 books at the same time right now, which is a horrible thing to do. But they're all prose. I have many poetry books that I'd like to write, including a children's series. But the books I'm writing are prose. A number of them would really kind of fall into your back of the pile category because they are self-help and self-empowerment. But in terms of a novel, I have a number of novels in mind, a sci-fi kind of a novel. I also, let me find it. I have it somewhere. It's basically, I had a sci-fi idea that all of a sudden came to mind, which hopefully will not offend. I thought the title certainly could be very offensive. But let's share it just for sharing's sake. The idea would be of multidimensional time travel, and if somebody can travel back in time, you know, most people would say, well, God, geez, if I were in the position that Hitler was in, for instance, I would do things completely different. So I thought, what an interesting perspective. I would love to write a sci-fi novel that would be called 47 Hitlers and give people different ideas and give them ability to go back in time and be Hitler for a specific point in time and see what they would have been doing different and kind of go through that. And not to say that, you know, being Hitler, he shouldn't have done things differently. But I thought the idea itself would be interesting. So in terms of, a novel that I have in mind, that would be the sci-fi novel that's there. Otherwise, books that I'm writing now are not novels per se. They are, I'm launching a school. I'm launching a school of human potential that deals with, a well-rounded individual because we, unfortunately, as a society, tend not to be well-rounded. We're very focused on certain elements, and then everything else kind of goes by the wayside. And I, ask myself a question of who is a modern man and what as a modern man do I need to know and what skills and knowledge do I need to have in order to be successful in life. And that's a book that I'm writing, and that's the reason why I'm launching this School of Human Potential. So that's one book. There's another one about respecting yourself, of the nine pillars of what it means to respect yourself. So there are many different things, but a lot of them really fall into that inspirational, self-help category.
That's interesting. Before I forget,
sure.
Marcia Cook has a show tomorrow at 10 o'clock Paranormal Hour with Andrea Perrone, is her special guest, the author of The House of Darkness, House of Light, and the author of the movie Conjuring. That's who that is.
Cool.
So she's going to be on her show tomorrow at 10. That's way past my bedtime, sorry. Will, of course, has a show tomorrow also. I'm not quite sure what time, that you can check in on the World of Ink. There's another poem that I would like to share. Could you share? We didn't read this one. Each day brings something else to learn. I love that poem.
Sure, I would love to. Page 128, I believe, when
yes.
we get there. Each day brings something else to learn. Each day brings something else to learn. The trick behind this is to yearn, for opportunities are endless. To seize them, you must be relentless. When you are down and things seem bleak and melancholy strikes, when all you want to do is speak of all of your dislikes, when rain is pouring outside and you forget the keys, embrace the storm and do not hide. At worst, you'll only sneeze. In everything, there is a chance for you to realize that once you take a second glance, truth will fill up your eyes.
Whoa, that is really nice. We have another question from Karen Vaughn.
Sure.
And
yeah.
Karen is the author of Daytona Dad and a whole bunch of killing people right on the spot. She writes with murder with a flair of funny, of comedy.
Nice.
And let me get the question back. What advice would you give someone that's just starting out writing?
To not worry about structure. To me,
okay.
writing is really just getting into your heart and putting out what's there. And whether you're writing a novel or a poem or something else, it's really you putting your feelings and your thoughts on paper. Don't worry about structure. Don't worry about outlines.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about what others would think about it. Just sit there and write. Don't worry. Don't have any expectations. And basically just get into that mode of putting pen to paper or putting your fingers on the keyboard, and what comes out. That would be my advice.
You know, that's interesting that you should say that, because Karen just said she doesn't outline either, neither do I. When I was working with kids in school as a writing and reading staff developer, the first thing, you know, you get reluctant writers and reluctant readers, and I would just say, when we were talking about what we were going to write about, and I would just say, forget the grammar. Put away the red pen to the teacher. Forget the red pen and just get them to say what they want to say.
Yeah.
And the fun part about it is kids don't realize that the minute you put your name on a composition, you become an author.
Right.
The minute you put your name on an email or a text, you're an author too, people. And that goes all over the world. So,
yep.
I mean, when kids say, I don't like to write, yeah, you do, because you've been texting, you've been emailing, you've been passing notes in class when you shouldn't, and, you know, you get caught, oh, well, too bad.
Yep.
And, yeah, we all did it. I mean, you have to be a saint, not to. I was such a perfect child, but, you know, never getting caught, whatever.
Hey, a number of the poems in my book are me basically writing something in my economics or math class, so it's right there.
Yeah, exactly. So she's saying creativity and the story is everything. So if you were to take, here's a good one, one poem, one specific poem, or one area, and decide to turn it into a novel, or which poem with it, or which section of the book could you think you could turn into like a regular story or a novel if you were just going to put one particular area of your life in a novel?
Good question. I just thought of it.
It wasn't on the paper. Sorry.
No. Oh no. It doesn't matter to me. The question is good, and I would say I probably would do either the infatuation chapter or the reflections. Infatuation. You know, there are so many kind of stories of people finding themselves and understanding what love is about. So that there are many storylines that can go there. The reflections, because I'm a very spiritual person and I have other abilities, so to speak, that would be very interesting in terms of developing that into a plot and seeing how those abilities open up for somebody who's just starting into.
Well, then that brings me to my next question that's not on the paper. If you were to take reflections just that particular section, and you turned it into a novel. Would you turn it into a novel so that teens learn the proper way to act and deal with adult situations that they're going to come into? Would you turn it into a YA, or would you turn it into an adult novel?
I would, maybe this is me, but I try to stay away from standards or particular taglines. What I would do is the main idea of Reflections is Know Thyself. And that would be the main storyline of discover who you really are, your essence. You know, what is it about you? And then you will know how to deal with the world. You will know how to deal with adult situations, because if you know who you are, you know the right path to take. So that's what I would be doing there.
That's interesting. Would you ever write a children's book?
Absolutely.
Just a plain children's book. Children's poem book.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that I'm planning on doing. And I realized, you know, when I went into my daughter's school, I actually had to write a couple of poems before I went in there, because I'm looking through all of my poems, and they're high school and beyond. Because the subject matter is very different, and I didn't have anything. So I just, you know, sat down basically a half an hour before going to my my daughter's reading, and I wrote a poem dealing with, you know, Angry Bird poem, as I called it, just to, you know, reflect and have an ability to translate into, you know, what they're dealing with at the moment. So, yeah, I would absolutely love to write a series of children's poetry books.
Yeah, a lot of the authors, there's books, children's books I've been reading, have a theme in the particular book, and it's usually a poem. It's a story, but it's written in poetry form. And it sort of gets the kids to want to read the book, even though it's, you know, even though it is a poem, it just says something, with, especially with the pictures, that go a long way. So
yeah.
I want to hear one more poem. Where is my other favorite poem? It pays to keep the book in front of me. Okay. The other poem that I thought, which is really great, because, you know, growing up, I was always overweight, and I was always the kid that, yeah, you know, she's the one that's very good at giving advice, but, you know, what can I say? And now that I lost a ton of weight, I'm skinny now. And after what they're going to do next week, whatever, I'm going to probably be skinnier. Not good. So this poem, I would say, I would love you to read, because my sister was a dancer. And her favorite thing was to, she did jazzercise, and she danced on stage. We all did. We danced at Carnegie Hall, except that I was a klutz and she wasn't. And I was just the person that danced with a mop on her head, seriously, and she danced with a tutu, because her sister, me, couldn't put, you know, I could barely tap, forget it. And my sister was a great dancer. And she always went to Broadway shows, and she danced in several Broadway shows, and she sang in Oklahoma and Carousel. She sang in a whole bunch of shows, and King and I. She had to leave. So could you read Life is a Dance? Because I think she's up there, and she would love to hear it.
Absolutely.
Page 61.
Yep, I'm there. So it's a song, but I'm not going to sing it. Parting is the girl is gone. 2 weeks went by in a flash. Hey, we had fun. I am still young, just a little low on cash. Time disappears, everything clears, now I can use my eyes. Too bad my cheers are full of tears, filling the glass of lies. Everything ends, so does romance, tearing this world apart. But life is a dance, so take a chance and give someone your heart.
That is so true.
She
loved to dance. That was her thing, and she met Gregory Hines outside of one of the theaters, and instead of saying, can I have your autograph, she just said to him, great tap. I'll never forget that. Nice. It was
very
nice. I said, Marcia Joyce, you just told Gregory Hines great tap, like he didn't know he could do it. she just said she couldn't, she could not, whatchamacallit, figure out what she was saying. That is funny. Okay,
if you like the dance, there is a poem, you know,
which one?
Two pages over, page 63, Okay. I love that song, and it's a song called I Just Wanted to Ask You to Dance.
Imagine that one, the wolf. Before we close, read that one. That is so beautiful. I just want to ask you to dance. Oh, because I used to sit on the side as a wallflower. I still do. I'm just such a klutz. Forget it. Doesn't matter.
This is a song. Imagine basically singing it to a waltz, because it's meant to be a waltz. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught somebody passing by. I glimpsed the girl I thought I knew. I turned and then saw you. You were looking somewhere else. You were dressed with blue seashells. And even though you weren't alone, I just had to say hello. I just wanted to ask you to dance. And I know that we haven't been friends, and I know that it has been a while, but I missed your incredible smile.
Mm.
And I thought that we could have been wrong when they started playing our song. So I couldn't just pass up this chance, and I wanted to ask you to dance.
Oh, so pretty.
Things that happened long ago, only you and I will know. We were careless and so young, and we both just wanted fun. But time has passed, and here we are. And even though I have been far, I much too often reminisce of the way in which you kiss. And then we have the I just wanted to ask you to dance part. You look so beautiful tonight, and there's a sparkle in your eyes. I'm hoping that it is for me, because with you I want to be. So please forgive me my mistakes. Love is a multi-layered cake, and let tonight be a new slice of our second paradise. And then I just wanted to ask you to dance. So it's one of my favorites.
This is just so beautiful. I think you have a new fan, because Karen Vaughn, not only does she love it, but I'm going to put you in an email with her, because she would like a copy of the book to review.
Oh, perfect. I love it.
And she is really one of my favorite reviewers, because she reviews on my site. And hold on, I think somebody wants to say hello. Let's see. Marsha, do you want to say hi? Are you there? I can't. Marsha? I think she's just listening. I can't tell. Anyway, Marsha, I think she has a show tomorrow. I'm not sure exactly what time. But Karen's going to give your book a shot. You're going to love it, because there are only certain poetry books that I'll read, seriously. And there are times, I have to be honest, that I'll take a book and I'll just summarize it and I won't say anything, whether I like it or not, or I'll just...
Mm-hmm.
Put it on the side. Now, I knew your book was coming, so that's different. But if I get a self-help book or a poetry book that I don't know is coming and I'm really not sure, I seriously won't write anything bad, because I don't believe in panning a book. I just won't review it.
Sure.
Because it's just not my thing. But for anybody that wants to know before we go, what am I reading? Stormfront, John Sanford. They just sent it to me. And yeah, they just sent me the new Baldacci book also, so I'll be looking at that. And for those of you that haven't gotten John Land's new book, it's coming out in December, The Tenth Circle. Once you start it, you can't put it down. Let me tell you, it is fantastic. I have the new Cindy McDonald book. That's on my to-read list. And for those of you that are sailors, Reckoning at Sea, Max J. Young wrote a true story about his 12-year journey on a sailboat around the world and what happened at the end when he got attacked by a gray whale.
Oh, wow.
It's a true story, and I wasn't sure about that one. And I read that one yesterday, and Karen wants an autographed copy of Why I Killed Her Off in my book, poor thing. I'm going to do my best after I get better and send you an autographed copy of Lies, Fears, and Betrayal, Faces 3. I also have to announce, because I am really stunned sometimes, that Satan's Holiday, compiled by Yvonne Mason, an anthology of scary stories, and guess what? I have one in there. And it scared the daylights out of me to write this one. And the title of my story is If They'd Only Listen, Beneath the Stones Lies the Truth, by Fran Lewis. And I am on the table of contents on the first page, page 99. You will find my story. And it scares me just to read it, so I won't. The picture that they picked for this story is just so scary. It's perfect. It's a cemetery, and it's got stones and whole bunch of ghosts there. And it says, if they only listen, beneath the stones lies the truth. And you could read it. It's all 12 pages of it. And it's about, I'll give you a hint, it's about an 18-year-old girl that goes around killing people for whatever reason on Halloween, and that's all I'll say about that. She's a serial killer, and there's a reason why she doesn't like people, and there's a reason why she's, getting revenge. So before we close, can you tell everybody where we can get a copy of your book, and real fast about your radio show? I don't want to forget that.
Oh, thank you very much. It's all over the Internet, so the easiest place would probably be Amazon or Barnes & Noble's. The publisher is Balboa Press, so you can go to Balboa's website and get it there in any of the formats it's available. In terms of my show, yes, I am a nationally syndicated radio talk show host, and the talk show is called Recalibrate Your Life with Ellen Vaisberg. It's on Law of Attraction Radio Network, and it's about 35 to 40 different channels syndicated to probably close to 2 million people a month.
Wow. And what are some of the things that you talk about on your show?
It falls into that category of the self-empowerment. I'm an entrepreneur of 14 years, and I was very successful in an IT career. But I wasn't very happy, so I recalibrated my life. And since then, started a practice helping other people do the same. And the show is about that, of what things can you do to get in touch with who you really are and to change your life for the better.
That is interesting. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I get better from what I'm doing, I'm going to email you.
Oh, that would be great, and best of luck.
Thank you. I'm going to need this. So I will see everybody on November 14th because it was just confirmed. New York Times bestselling author Archer Mayer, Three Can Keep a Secret, will be my guest that day. The following week on November 20th on Chat Time on Red River Radio, this will be about 10, 15 different unsuspecting authors that I'm not going to tell why they're on the show. I just invited them on the show. Karen's one of them, Delaney. Marsha's going to make a guest appearance, John Land, Alan Topol, Mark Rubenstein, Mark Schaff, and a whole bunch of other authors, and I'm not telling you why I invited them on the show. They're just going to be there. And the next day I'm going to be interviewing Ray Anthane and first Charles Sulzberg, the John List murders that happened in 1971. It is going to be great. And yeah, Karen, it's going to be very interesting. Wait till you read my questions, people, and wait till you find out the truth about why you're on the show. I can't tell you that. That would spoil my fun. And on that note, Alan, I want to thank you so very, very much. And when your next book comes out, you have to contact me so I can read it.
Thank you very much. I love being a part of the show. Thank you for the review, and thanks for everybody for listening.
Thank you so much, and everybody, I will see you November 14th, and good night.
Good night.